A standoff with police in Missoula ends peacefully. Good evening, I'm Courtney Anderson.
And I'm Connor Ballantyne, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Flathead reporter Katrin Fry takes us out with some young volunteers in Glacier Park. And in our feature interview, Capitol reporter Dan Boyes talks with Congressman Steve Daines about cutting more trees and food benefits. A standoff with police that began early yesterday morning on Missoula's north side ended peacefully about 3:30 this morning when the man holed it up in his trailer walked out and surrendered to police. Neither he or the woman who was staying with him in the trailer were injured. Police spokesman Sergeant Travis Welsh says skilled negotiators coaxed the man to surrender.
You know, we have a talented squad of negotiators at the Missoula Police Department, and these people are very patient. They're quick thinkers and good talkers, as it were, and negotiators were doing what they could to communicate with this gentleman throughout this ordeal. Sometimes it was very difficult, but eventually it led to him walking out of the residence and being taken into custody without injury to anybody involved.
Welsh says drugs were likely involved in the incident, but the investigation is ongoing. The man remains in custody, as is the woman who was with him. But Welsh says she's been charged under an outstanding warrant unrelated to yesterday's incident.
She had been staying there in that that trailer for about the last 4 to 6 weeks with him. So there's nothing to indicate that she played an active role in the resistance to law enforcement. Or that she had an active role in the original disturbance that was the reason for the neighbor or the roommate's call. At this point, it just feels like she was a bystander who was in a bad place.
Welsh says he expects the investigation into the incident to be completed tomorrow.
And in other news from around the state, a student in the building trades program at Flathead Valley Community College in Kalispell has died in a fall. The Flathead County Sheriff's Office says 60-year-old Peter Mollum of Big Fork was working on a class project yesterday morning when he fell backward off scaffolding from a height of about 8 feet and into a 55-gallon barrel. The fall is still under investigation. FVCC President Jane Karras said it was a sad, tragic day for the college and that their thoughts and prayers were with the student's family.
Women's rights advocates have filed a formal complaint against a Montana district judge who sentenced a former teacher convicted of raping a student to 30 days in prison. Representatives from the Montana chapter of the National Organization for Women, or NOW, and the group Ultraviolent delivered the complaint against Judge G. Todd Baugh today. The complaint accuses Judge Baugh of showing bias when he said the 14-year-old victim was older than her chronological age. Montana NOW President Marion Bradley says if the state does not seek action against Baugh, then her group will work to make sure he is not reelected next November.
We will lead an effort along with a lot of other people in Yellowstone County and probably throughout the state saying, no, you need to go. This is not okay.
Judge Baugh has since apologized for his words in the case, but Marion Bradley says no apology is good enough. She says blaming victims in such a way is part of our country's rape culture that needs to change.
It is what tells women and men that it is not okay to report rape.
The formal complaint also faults Baugh for giving former teacher Stacey Rambold a lenient sentence, which prosecutors have since appealed as legal. Rambold was convicted of raping a Billings senior high school student in 2007. Victim Charisse Morales killed herself in 2010 before the case went to trial. Rambold received 15 years in prison with all but a month suspended for the rape. He is due to be released from the state prison in Deer Lodge on Thursday. The complaint against Judge Baugh goes before the State Judicial Standards Commission. If the five-member commission decides Baugh's actions were inappropriate, it can send the complaint up to the Montana Supreme Court, which has the power to remove him from the bench. Court officials say judge complaints have reached the state's high court just 6 times in the past 25 years.
A Missoula City Council committee meets tomorrow to discuss a proposal that would allow the mayor to begin negotiations to purchase Mountain Water Company. Mayor John Engen presented the council with the draft ordinance yesterday. Proposals that would have the city of Missoula acquire Mountain Water are nothing new, but the issue took on a renewed emphasis almost 2 years ago when the company's previous owner sold it to global alternative assets manager, the Carlyle Group. Opponents argued it would be unwise to sell the city's lone municipal water utility to a large out-of-state corporate entity, but eventually the Carlyle Group agreed to give Missoula the first crack at buying the utility if it ever went up for sale. The Carlyle Group declined comment today, and Mayor Engen was out of the office sick. But City Council President Marilyn Marler says there seems to be a lot of interest in this proposal.
It seems like water is a pretty basic resource for people and for the community of Missoula, and it seems like it would be good to have that in public ownership.
Marler says this seems to be as good a time as any to start to make an offer to buy the water system back.
The city's actually been trying to buy it for a long time, and it wasn't for sale repeatedly. It seems like now, based on what I've heard from people that are doing more of the research and negotiations, that Mountain Water Company has not been as profitable as they had expected, and that might make it a good time to sell or at least negotiate the sale. And it's also my understanding that as the economy's picking up, that interest rates could start going back up again, so it might be a good time to try to do that now as well.
Marler says she's heard of a potential quote of $50 million for the company, but that is only an unofficial estimate. In a memo to the city council, staff, and Missoulians dated yesterday, Mayor Engen wrote the city would make an offer based on a variety of market-based factors used to determine value that would be contingent on an understanding of the condition of the system and some other unknown factors. The memo noted that in the near term, Mountain Water customers would notice very little change. The memo also stated the city could purchase the system through revenue bonds and manage the debt without an immediate rate increase. It notes rates would eventually have to be raised. That would be subject to public hearings. That revenue would eventually be reinvested into the system. The memo also mentions that if negotiations were to fail, the city could also consider acquiring the company through eminent domain proceedings. That means a court would decide on a fair market value for the system, and the city would be required to compensate Carlyle accordingly. The Missoula City Council's Committee of the Whole meets tomorrow at 3 in City Council chambers to consider the proposal. That meeting is open to the public.
Introducing young people to careers in the Park Service and checking some projects off the to-do list are among the goals of a new Glacier Park program. The Glacier Youth Corps Partnership just wrapped up the first of two summers of volunteer work at the park. Flathead reporter Katrin Fry has more on how this program fits into the park goals of connecting with the next generation and resume building for the volunteers.
At the edge of the inside North Fork Road is the Rocky Point Trail. We're hiking up it, looking for the Montana Conservation Corps crew that is cleaning up the trail. This land up above Lake McDonald burned during the Robert Fire of 2003. Tall gray and black trees tower above the 10-year-old bright green lodgepole pine that reach about 5 feet tall. Volunteer coordinator Jessica Kusky with Glacier Park says volunteers on this day are cleaning up downed trees along the trail. Kusky says the Glacier Youth Corps Partnership is open to young people aged 15 to 24.
I think anyone who has a love of nature wants to get out there and experience their national parks and isn't afraid of doing a little bit of hard work.
Kusky says it's an opportunity for the park to get different projects completed and for the volunteers to learn about careers in the Park Service. We don't catch up with the crew on the trail. They're too far ahead and working too fast. But we see freshly sawn logs pushed off to the side of the trail, showing where the crew has already passed. Around 4 in the afternoon, back at the trailhead, the crew returns. They've been working in the wilderness, so no chainsaws. Long, leather-wrapped crosscut saws are slung over shoulders, bouncing with each step as the volunteers make their way back to the dark green Suburban with the Montana Conservation Corps logo stenciled on the side. This is the last workday for the summer for these volunteers. 23-year-old Helen Burke of Maine got involved with the Montana Conservation Corps after graduating from college last year and loved it.
I went to college for environmental science and sustainable development, and this kind of program helps you connect to your communities and your environment in a really awesome way. So I happened to fall right into that, and it was pretty cool. So I was a member last year and got to be in the immersion crew, where we got to be in the Bob Marshall Wilderness for 3 whole months, and it was a mind-blowing experience and learned a lot about myself and how to be part of a group.
Montana Conservation Corps, or MCC, is one of the partners working with Glacier Park on the Youth Corps project. Crews from the MCC worked at the park this summer, as well as in places like the Bob Marshall Wilderness. Burke says her experience helps her know that this is what she wants to do.
A lot of people have gone through the Montana Conservation Corps that are working in public lands, so either in the Glacier National Park or with the Forest Service around here, and it's really cool to come across those people and know that at least maybe even a quarter of them did MCC, and that was their first step in the door, where they really got to see what type of work was going on, got their name out there, and now are actually working for the park or working for the Forest Service. So that's, for me, that's encouraging to see, because I could maybe go that way as well.
Over a 10-week period this past summer, volunteers worked on trails, collected data for Glacier citizen science projects, native plant restoration, historic structure maintenance, noxious weed control, and backcountry shelter repair. The volunteers were working alongside staff from the park's fire management office, maintenance crews, and the Crown of the Continent Research Learning Center. Kusky says the project also aims to connect the next generation with Glacier Park.
The youth are going to be the stewards of our national parks in the future, and so I believe this is an opportunity for them to get a more intimate look at what we do as park rangers and get a greater understanding of what the Park Service is responsible for managing.
The Glacier Youth Corps Partnership is a 2-year pilot program. This first summer was funded through a $55,000 grant from the Glacier National Park Conservancy, and a matching $55,000 grant from the National Park Foundation will fund next summer's program. People interested in volunteering can contact Jessica Kusky at Glacier Park or the Montana Conservation Corps office in Kalispell. Katrin Fryt reporting from the Flathead.
Montana's Congressman Steve Daines is touting a bill he is co-sponsoring, which would increase logging on national forest lands. The Restoring Healthy Forests for Healthy Communities Act passed the U.S. House last Friday. Supporters say the bill would boost local economies near forest land and help lower the risk of catastrophic wildfires like those seen near Yosemite National Park this summer. But the bill faces some stiff opposition, including from the Obama administration. In tonight's feature interview, Capitol reporter Dan Boyce speaks with Congressman Daines about that bill and Daines' recent vote to cut the federal food stamp program called SNAP. The Republican-led House passed the SNAP cuts last week over opposition from Democrats. It would cut SNAP by $4 billion annually for the next decade. First, back to its forest bill. Congressman Daines says growing up in Montana, he was an avid outdoorsman who spent a great deal of time in the backcountry, but he also says he remembers a thriving timber industry. He says timber harvest in the state has declined 90% on national forest lands since the early 80s.
So this bill will increase timber harvest in Montana across all 10 national forests. It will create 5,000 jobs. Importantly, and this is why we have the county commissioners behind this bill and the National Education Association, the NEA, supports this bill because it generates tax revenues for these communities for schools and infrastructure. We have these communities in Montana that depend on the timber industry for revenues because they're surrounded by national forests. There's no tax base there. The federal government doesn't pay taxes. And so this is why this bill is so important, and we're thrilled to see it pass in a bipartisan fashion. In fact, the ranking member, the senior Democrat on the Natural Resources Committee, Congressman DeFazio of Oregon, voted for this bill because, again, he's from a timber state, understands why it's important that we start restoring the timber industry across these western states.
But a major part of the bill is to address some of the root causes of these wildfires across the U.S., especially in the West.
Well, it is, and we're never going to be able to eliminate catastrophic wildfires, unfortunately. It's nature's way oftentimes of restoring a forest. But we can reduce the risk of these catastrophic wildfires by fuel reduction. You know, I spent a lot of time, Dan, this summer. I flew over that Rock Creek fire outside of Red Lodge, flew over the Lolo fire outside of Missoula. Speaking with the firefighters, the Forest Service personnel, they will tell you that we need to have better forestry practices, fuel reduction practices that will never eliminate catastrophic wildfire, but we can reduce the risk. And when there's a catastrophic wildfire, it is an environmental disaster. It can destroy watersheds through erosion. The amount of SO2 and CO2 and mercury emitted in a wildfire is significant. And so we're better environmental stewards when we have better timber management practices.
Following the House passage, the Obama administration issued an immediate veto threat on this bill, and other opponents say the bill sets unrealistic deadlines and mandates for harvest. harms protected roadless areas and curtails public input on timber sales on national forest lands?
Well, first of all, remember, we can't harvest timber in federally designated wilderness. So this applies to our national forests. And you know, we used to have a thriving timber industry. The hearings demonstrated that the problem is we have these fringe groups, oftentimes extreme groups, that are filing these lawsuits sometimes on technicalities and procedural basis that are holding up timber harvest in the state of Montana as well as other western states. So I think the president's a bit premature in casting judgment on this bill. I sure hope he would be willing to sit down as we work with the Senate, as we work with Senator Tester and Senator Baucus in a bipartisan fashion to find a way through this and to craft legislation that will work in the Senate as well as the House and get the president to sign it.
Would the bill not push harvest and therefore necessarily roads into areas that are now considered roadless areas?
Well, there'll be we have millions of acres of national forests, and clearly Montanans want to have a balance between conservation, preservation, the ability to enjoy the outdoors, but we also need to have jobs and tax revenues for our schools and county infrastructure. So Montanans want to see both, and I think sometimes it's the extremes on either of them that seem to drive this argument, this either-or approach. I'm convinced most Montanans want to see a both-and approach. They want to work where they also like to play, as we say in Montana, but you got to have a job so you can stay in the state.
Others argue that a bill like this may not be addressing the root problem of these catastrophic wildfires, the continuing effects of climate change. Is that something that needs to be done at the federal level in Congress?
Well, there's multiple factors around why we're seeing wildfires. I mean, we see beetle kill going on as well. And in fact, what's frustrating for many across Montana is we see beetle kill move through a forest and we can't even go in and harvest these trees that are standing dead timber. And you have about 2 or 3 years to harvest those trees. They are still salvageable for lumber purposes, but then beyond that, then they become just rotting trees, but they become part of the wildfire risk. So there's multiple fronts we need to battle to reduce catastrophic wildfires. And so that's why it's important here that we restore our timber harvest, and it will, again, get the jobs back and start reducing some of the risk of wildfires.
Is climate change legislation something that should be pursued as well?
Well, you know, there's a lot of debate right now going on climate change. The climate is dynamic. The climate is always either heating or cooling. I think the real question is going to be what effects would some of these policies have in terms of hardworking Montanans and taxpayers in terms of potentially raising their energy prices, reducing tax revenues to their counties as it relates to natural resources. And so I think, you know, the debate's a broad debate. There's a lot of consequences to some of these policies. And so I think we're going to stay focused on the cause and effect here of what it means to put some of these policies in place, what it might mean to rising energy prices.
I want to move now to talking about the Nutrition Reform and Work Opportunity Act. This is a nearly $40 billion cut to food stamps over the next 10 years. The House passed it last week on a party line vote. SNAP, or food stamps, has traditionally been part of the farm bill, part of a grand bargain of sorts between Republicans and Democrats, farm subsidies for food stamp subsidies. Mm-hmm. Is splitting out SNAP benefits from the farm bill program, is that a sign of the type of political gridlock that is becoming more common in Washington today?
Well, if you kind of look back in the history of the farm bill, and I voted for the first farm bill that came in the House floor when the SNAP was combined with the ag portion. But what's interesting is that when we talk about the farm bill, 20% of the farm bill is actually ag-related policy. 80% are food stamps. And so it's almost a bit of a misnomer to call the farm bill, which really is the food stamp bill with some ag policy attached to it. So I supported the original farm bill when it went through the House. I think there were some good reforms made in the ag side and the food stamp side that got me to the point where I said I can vote and support this. The reality was it wasn't going to pass the House without dividing it up. And we got it through in two different bills. We got the ag portion through. We got the food stamp portion bill. And in some ways what it does, it provides more transparency. So the taxpayer, the American people, can really see what is in the food stamp bill and what is in the ag bill. Sometimes when bills get large back in Washington, they start getting jammed stuff into these 1,000-page bills. That doesn't always produce the best policy.
Some Montana statistics on the SNAP program, $190 million a year. There are about 55,000 children that are on SNAP in Montana, 9,000 seniors. Congressman Daines, the Congressional Budget Office estimates the cuts you voted for in this act would result in 4 million people being denied SNAP benefits next year. 4 million low-income people, low-income families, looking at a nation that does have problems with hunger and problems with poverty. Is this the right way to address these social ills as a nation looking to fix them?
Well, it's and we spent a lot of time really digging into the numbers here on that on the SNAP bill, the food stamp bill. It's important to me that we really understand what we're voting for, what the reforms are looking like, because there are many, many Montanans, as you mentioned, Dan, that depend on this program. It is an important safety net for families, children who are in need. But here's the challenge we face. In 2006, the spending on food stamp was $33 billion. What was proposed in this latest food stamp bill was $82 billion. In other words, the food stamp spending is up 150% in the last 7 years. What we passed in the House was reducing that spending by 5% in light of the fact it's gone up 150% in the last 7 years. What it is, it took the spending from $82 billion a year down to $78 billion a year. The $40 billion they talk about is the fact that it went from $82 billion to $78 billion, but they score that over 10 years. So it's $4 billion times 10 years. That's the $40 billion number. The reality is it's about a 5% reduction in food stamp spending in light of the fact that food stamp spending is up 150%. We believe there's significant opportunity to find savings in the fraud, waste, and abuse that's going on in the food stamp program. Anytime you have that explosion in spending in a federal program, it opens up the potential for waste, fraud, and abuse. And we've got some reforms counted in that bill. So I think what you're really going to see happen here is it's not that we're going to have truly the truly needy here seeing their benefit cut. We're going to see a ability here to save some dollars here because there are some people out there who are gaming the system and there's fraud in the system today. But we'll see what comes out of the Senate. You know, we've sent our bill over to the Senate. There will be a compromise between the two houses. That's the way that James Madison framed it at the beginning of this country. There's a House, there's a Senate. We pass separate bills. There'll be a conference. There'll be a compromise. And I'm sure what will come out will be something different than came out than we passed in the House last week.
You mentioned the Senate. A lot of Montanans are looking over to Montana's soon-to-be empty Senate seat. Are you going to be running for Senate, Congressman Daines?
Well, I'll tell you right now, I've got a pretty big to-do list. We got the farm bill passed. We got the CR. We've got Obamacare we're dealing with. We've got the debt ceiling and so forth. So I'm staying focused on doing the job I was elected to do. Most Montanans, I think, feedback I've had is they think these Senate races were far too long last time. The airways were flooded with TV commercials, postcards, and it's the nature of Senate races, it seems. But having said that, we're giving it serious consideration. It requires thoughtful deliberation, and my wife and I are giving a lot of thought to it, having a lot of conversations across Montana about the potential race. But there's not been an open seat for the United States Senate in 36 years. The last time it was open was when Max Baucus ran for it. So it's a very, very important seat for Montana. We're getting that serious consideration. We also recognize we got to make a decision here pretty soon, and we'll get things sorted out here in the not-too-distant future.
Yeah, do you have a drop-dead deadline for when that decision needs to be made to be a viable candidate?
Yeah, I don't. I enjoy the job that I was sent to do for the people of Montana, serving the House. In some ways, you know, the congressional seat is the entire state of Montana. A Senate seat's the entire state of Montana. So I serve the same people either way. In 2014, it's a statewide race either way. But we recognize you also have to get a decision made so other people can make their plans. If we decide to run for the Senate, there'll be an open House seat. And so we'll get it sorted out here in the not-too-distant future.
Okay. Congressman Steve Daines, very interesting discussion, sir. Thank you for your time.
Thanks, Dan. Appreciate your time, too.
Now for tonight's weather forecast. For west of the Divide, a winter storm warning is in effect from noon tomorrow to Thursday for areas above 6,000 feet in the Bitterroot Sapphire Mountains. Another winter storm warning is in effect from 6 p.m. this evening to midnight tomorrow for areas above 6,000 feet in the West Glacier region. Tonight, expect rain showers and lows in the 30s. Tomorrow, expect rain showers and highs to be in the 40s and mid-50s. For central Montana, a winter weather advisory is in effect until noon Thursday for elevations above 5,500 feet for the Rocky Mountain Front in central and southern Lewis and Clark. A winter weather advisory is in effect from noon tomorrow to Thursday for elevations above 5,500 feet for Cascade, Judith Basin, Fergus, and Marr counties. Tonight will be rainy in the evening with lows around 35 to 45 degrees. Tomorrow calls for cloudy skies with a chance of rain and snow in the afternoon. Highs will be around 45 to 55 degrees. And for southwest Montana, a winter storm warning is in effect from 9 a.m. tomorrow to noon Thursday for elevations above 5,500 feet for Beaverhead, Broadwater, Madison, Jefferson, and Gallatin counties. A winter weather advisory is in effect from 9 a.m. tomorrow to noon Thursday for elevations below 5,500 feet for those same counties. Tonight, rain and snow are likely with lows around 30 to 40 degrees. Tomorrow will be cloudy with rain and snow. Highs will be in the upper 40s. And now for the editorial comments of Al Smith.
For me, these crisp autumn mornings mean the big game hunting season is near. Right now, hunters are out sighting in their rifles. The general rifle season for elk, deer, and antelope opens next month. Hunting is a family tradition in Montana. A higher percentage of our population hunts than in any other state. And it is common to see hunting parties of two or three generations in the woods and on the prairies throughout Montana. Unfortunately, a Montana family may lose a loved one to a hunting accident. While any loss of life is tragic, we are doing better with safety training and safer guns. It's good to remind ourselves and our hunting companions to be extra careful with guns. Those of us who do own and use firearms, whether for hunting or sport shooting, need to make sure that we emphasize safe gun handling practices for ourselves and those we are shooting with. We need to reinforce the safe handling of guns, remembering to treat each and every weapon as if it were loaded. We have come to place too much trust in the mechanical safeties on our guns, but that trust is misplaced. 13 years ago, here in Montana, 9-year-old Gus Barber lost his life when a hunting rifle that was being unloaded fired unexpectedly. Most of us who heard the news reports at the time were saddened to hear the reports, and it was especially so for parents confronted with the unimaginable pain of losing a child. For those of us who hunt, especially with our kids, it was a sober reminder of the inherent danger of firearms and the need to reinforce safe gun handling practices. I've talked before about defective products that injure and kill unsuspecting Americans. Our lives or those of our families or friends can be quickly and severely altered by a defective product. Unfortunately, the tragedy of the loss of 9-year-old Gus Barber's life caused in part by a defective product. While a Remington Model 700 rifle was being unloaded, the rifle's safety was released and the gun fired. The gun firing was an unexpected event for Gus's family. A Remington Model 700 rifle accidentally discharging, however, was not unexpected by Remington. Over the years, thousands of Remington Model 700 rifles have discharged unexpectedly, including many here in Montana. Faced with owner complaints and lawsuits, Remington, making a cost-benefit analysis, chose not to recall the rifles. Remington chose instead to issue a statement to Remington rifle owners about proper gun handling. The statement did not alert Remington owners that there was a potential design defect with their rifles that required attention to safety. Remington knew its Model 700 rifles had problems. They even launched an internal program to develop a safer rifle. And they did develop a safer rifle, but chose not to market it. We know all this about Remington Model 700 rifles because the victims of the tragedies that resulted from Remington's design defect have come to trial lawyers for help. Trial lawyers and the victims' concerned family members, like Gus's dad, Rich Barber, have uncovered the internal documents showing Remington's knowledge of this problem and of their knowledge of safer alternatives. One of the legal aspects of the Remington story has received little attention over the years. secrecy agreements in previous litigation prevented much information about the dangers of the rifles from being made public. One of the benefits of being a trial lawyer is that you get to help people. Unfortunately, people usually only seek the assistance of a trial lawyer when they or a member of their family has been severely injured or killed. I've had the good fortune to work with and become friends with Rich Barber. With Rich's hard work, we have been able to pass legislation in Montana to ban these secrecy agreements. Rich's purpose was clear and concise. He didn't want another family to face the tragedy he has had simply because knowledge of a dangerous product was hidden from public view by a secrecy agreement. A similar law is needed on the federal level. While there's been no mandatory recall, Remington is offering to modify the defective mechanism for its models 700, 721, 722, 600, 660, XP100, and 40X. You can check the safety modification program at Remington.com under the safety tab or call 800-243-9700 for the details of the program. There are still millions of defective rifles out there and thousands here in Montana. Please make sure one of them isn't yours or one of your hunting buddies. Gus Barber's death prompted me years ago to make this yearly plea. I do it because every year I hear from a listener who has had a defective Remington repaired. Safe gun handling practices are not enough. These rifles are defective. Enough is enough. Check your guns, tell your family and friends, and just get these Remington rifles fixed. Don't wait until another Montana family's fall hunting tradition turns into yet another preventable tragedy. Please do it this season. This is Al Smith for the Montana Trial Lawyers.
Al Smith is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition, and the views expressed do not necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org. I'm Connor Valentine.
And I'm Courtney Anderson. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.